Let me introduce the book of Esther in this way. In the book of Esther, there is the time that's repeated several times in Jewish history when the plan of God almost stopped. Now, we're not quite to that in the book of Esther, but if you know anything at all about the book of Esther, the ruler of the world made a decree that is irreversible. Persian rules are rules that are irreversible. It's not like you, the Congress or Parliament can rescind a rule that's been made. Any rule made by the Persians could never be taken away. And so in the book of Esther, there is that time, and we'll talk about how it developed, but there is that time when the Persian king sent a decree to the Persian world. You look in chapter 1 of the book of Esther, and you'll see that he ruled over 127 provinces. And I know that's not necessarily nations. That can be political divisions. But if you conquer the world and you conquer, Jerusalem, would not that be one of your provinces? If you conquer, Syria, would that not be one of your provinces? And you might have a North Syria and a South Syria and an East Syria and a West Syria. But you stop and think about it. You look at those Old Testament maps, and sometimes you might want to Google that and look at the extent of the Roman world, the extent of the Babylonian world, the extent of the Persian world, and the Persian world was perhaps the largest of any of them. And here is a decree that went to the entire world. And it said, on a particular day, every Jew on this earth can be killed and there's no penalty. As, preparation for this class, I just thought, what if that had happened? I mean, you think about an anti-Semitic feeling in our own society. You had that same attitude toward the Jews in biblical times, and they were despised. And so here you get permission that says, on that day, every Jew on this earth can be put to death and you can plunder his goods. How's that for a, get out of jail free kind of card? Do you understand what I'm talking about? You've got a Jewish friend and he's the banker downtown, or you've got a Jewish friend and he's got a very successful business. And on a particular day, every Jew on this earth can be killed. And there's no penalty. And you can take his goods. You're talking about duck season, deer season. You understand what duck season is? You know what deer season is? Jonathan preached in Mississippi for several years. And on Sunday morning, whenever it was, I guess it was deer season, those guys had been hunting all night on Saturday night. Evidently, deer season started on a Saturday morning. They hunted all day Saturday night. They came to church in their hunting clothes with their guns. And as soon as church was over, they went back out and they went deer hunting again, or duck hunting, or whatever it was. Now imagine having a worldwide kill a Jew day and take his possessions. That's why this book has some really, really important considerations. Now the Jews celebrate this time, and they read the scriptures at the, I think they read it at the time the feast is called the Feast of Purim. I'm talking about modern day Jews. And whenever they read the scriptures, every time in a public assembly, the enemy in this book, his name is Haman. And every time they read the name Haman, the audience erupts with disdain and groaning and I won't say cursing, but just a size of adversity toward this man Haman, because he's the instigator of all of this. Now we haven't talked about Haman yet. We're not quite to that level in the introduction of the book. But why is this book in the Bible? Well, there are a lot of reasons, but I believe that one of the things that we'll see more than anything else is to see how much God is in control of situations. Now, you become a Jew, and you know that about one year from the time the decree goes out, that within about a year's time, you know, it's going to be hunting season for you and your family. Men, women, child, infants, kill them every one. You throw up your hands in despair because they're not in Palestine. They're not in the promised land. They don't own Jerusalem. They're in the process of regaining it. And so Esther is sort of contemporaneous with Zerubbabel and Ezra and Nehemiah in that same period of time. But they don't have any walled cities. They don't have the protections that they might have had at other times. They're just scattered. Talk about the Babylonian captivity. That's where they are. And I think it is interesting. Did you notice in the early chapters, I believe, is it verse 2 or verse 3 that mentions one nation by name of the 127 provinces? Did you see that name that's in there? What is it? I hope it's in the early verses of chapter 1. Ethiopia. Where's Ethiopia? You know, you stop thinking where Ethiopia is. I mean, you go to Bible lands, and you leave Bible lands, you go down the Sinaitic Peninsula, and then you get down to the land of Egypt. And Egypt owns almost all of the Nile River. And when you keep going down and down and down and down and get almost a third of the way down in Africa, because Africa is a huge continent, is where Ethiopia is. Now, I just think it's significant that Ethiopia is mentioned. Now, the situation in chapter 1 is, and I'm not going to reteach everything that Bill taught, is the deposing of Vashti, King Ahasuerus' wife. There's a feast that's going on. The feast lasts, how many months is it? Remember that? I don't know how much in detail you went last week looking at this. There is a banquet that goes on for 6 months. Who's at the banquet? Well, just everybody. Every ruler of the 127 provinces is there. Talk about what we have, the state dinner for the president of France. Was that yesterday? Was that earlier this week? And all of the hoopla there was about now we're going to really have. Imagine a world state dinner that has 127 world rulers together. You're talking about a united nation or something. I don't know exactly how you would describe it. And so this thing is going on and on. And then that right at the last, there's a 7-day feast, and all these guys are drunk. And Vashti, who is the queen, is very beautiful. And so sends words to Vashti, come and stand before all these men and let them, the word lust after your beauty is not there, but let them see how beautiful you are. Her response is probably indicative of the fact that the word lust is almost in that passage by implication. And she said, I'm not going to do it. Now, at the same time, you read chapter 1, Vashti, she's got a banquet going on for all of the women. She's got a banquet going on for all of the women. And so she will not come. Problem develops because the wife that is supposed to be treated like this in those times, those period of time, she's out of control. And so those who are around Ahasuerus says, well, you've got a problem. It's not just in your house. When this word gets out that the queen of the world has rebuked, has not done what her husband said, we've got some marriage problems that are really, really going to develop in a hurry. And so he deposes her. I found it rather interesting. This is a bit of trivia just in passing, but I was reading, trying to find Herodotus's discussion of how big the walls in Babylon were. I talked about that 2 weeks ago. Maybe it was in the sermon I talked about the walls of Babylon. I was just wondering, read that once again, and never found it because I got intrigued by another part of Herodotus's description, and that is the Babylonian world, every woman, even women of nobility, had their appointed times, or they were forced to go and serve as we might call it a temple prostitute, go to a house of prostitution and be available for any man that happened to be there, and she could not say no to anybody. And Herodotus is writing about this. See, this is so far into our culture. I don't know if it's all that far into our culture in relationship to what King Ahasuerus wanted to happen to Vashti. And once she had sex with him, if she met him outside in the courtyard, he gave her a coin, and that coin was a sign that she was a goddess. She was approved by the gods of Persia. Is that a sick world? I think our world is headed in that exact same direction. So here's the plan. Let's find a new wife. And so they start looking for a new wife for the king. And they send the word to 127 provinces to bring the most beautiful young virgins. I think it's interesting. Virgin is in that description, and young is in that description. And so the world, that goes out, it's in chapter 2, goes out to all the world, and they're brought to Shushan, the palace, that's where the king's palace is, and they're kept there for a year in training. Now, in among this number is the person in this book, and that's Esther. And so the way she was to be picked, at the appointed time, those virgins would be brought before the king, and it would be his selection as to which of those became his wife. And there's a listing of all the things they did. There was a eunuch that was in charge of these virgins. Sometimes we don't understand everything's involved in being a eunuch, but eunuchs are men who have been castrated. They do not have sexual desires. And so the nobility of the king didn't want some little sweet thing coming up to the cook in the palace and sweet talk him and said, honey, if you'll just poison the king, you know, we'll party. I don't know exactly what she would say. No, we'd have a eunuch, so we could not be seduced in that way. That's interesting. Ethiopian eunuch was Secretary of Treasury of all of Ethiopia. Queen Candace was her name. And so there are these eunuchs in charge of these virgins. And they're perfuming them. And there's a description there in chapter 2 of everything that is involved. When it's Esther's turn to go before the king, they're allowed to take anything they want to take with them to be with the king. And Esther says to that eunuch, by the way, this eunuch really approved of her and gave her special treatment and everything, and she asked counsel and advice of him, and he told her exactly what to take. The Bible doesn't indicate what it was. Long story short, she was chosen to be queen. Now, at that part, there are some things that we may not understand about all of this. But I want us to get to chapter 3 tonight, because in the latter part of chapter 2, we're introduced to Esther's, the one who raised Esther. The New King James describes this man Mordecai as his relation. Mordecai's uncle's daughter is who Esther is. I think your uncle's daughter is your cousin. Is that the way it works out? You know, you think you've got an uncle and that's your cousin? I think that's the relationship. And he's raised her, and he's put some real values in her. We'll see that in this class tonight. And but Mordecai, concerned about what's happening to Esther before she's ever chosen, is out in the courtyard around the king's palace and overhears a plot to kill King Ahasuerus. And so Bill would have, you know, talked some about this last week. He tells Esther. Esther tells the king, and the two individuals are put to death. Those two individuals, given their names even in the Bible, those two individuals are put to death. And you thought, oh, well, that's interesting. Wonder why that's in the Bible. Well, it becomes important later in the story of Esther. But this is a book we don't study. Men hardly ever study Esther. Women's classes every now and then will study Esther. They don't study what I think in many respects are the last two or three chapters. It gets even more biblically centered when you get to the implications of all that happened, and especially the last chapter. We've only got three verses. And those three verses are really important. And I've been, in preparing for this class, been made to recognize how important those three verses are. We'll talk about those when we get to chapter 10. But when you get to chapter 3, for some reason, there is this man, Haman. And so if you want to, if you're real Jewish and everything, you can start saying boo every time I say Haman. No, don't do that. But that's what would happen. And they'd be reading the text, and all of a sudden, here is this Haman. And so in the synagogue, as this is read, in modern Judaism, every time you read the name, you give a sound that says you do not approve of this man Haman. And even little children, they really love this Jewish feast, the Feast of Purim, it is called. We'll talk about where that name comes from. But it's the Feast of Purim because they read it, because it is a great time of the celebration of how the Jews were kept alive. You think about our July the 4th, celebration of independence. And, you know, depending on how much you love America and how pro-American you are in relationship to that, it used to be a real, real celebrating time. And so the Jews, Mordecai sets up a Jewish feast day. And so they still honor this feast. And it's even mentioned in the New Testament. But there is that evidence early in the chapter of Haman's advancement and the adoration, and this is in the king's third year. I've got some time markers in here to help us understand. When you're in the first chapter, you know, it's evidently pretty early in the life of King Ahasuerus. But in the third year of his reign, you've got this situation that develops. And everybody is bowing down to Haman. When he walks out of the king's palace, there is the presidential car, and there's the bands, and there's the military. I'm making all this up, but I'm trying to give us a modern thing. There's the celebration. Here is the most important person other than the king in this cabinet. And so everybody bows down before Haman, except Mordecai, Queen Esther's cousin. And it drives Haman insane, really drives him insane. And it just keeps bothering him and bothering him. And so he devises in chapter 3 a plan to destroy the Jews. He goes to the king of the world and he said, you've got some people in these 127 provinces that are nothing but troublemakers. And they're scattered evidently all over the place, because the decree to kill these Jewish people, this decree goes to all 127 provinces. And so here are the Jews down in Ethiopia. I mean, that nation is specifically mentioned. Get a globe or Google it or Google the world map and just see the distance it is to go from Iraq, Iran, over in that area, to just go all the way up to Syria and down through the Promised Land and cross the Sinai Peninsula and go down to Egypt, go down the river Euphrates. The Jews have been scattered everywhere. And so he says, you've got some troublemakers in this kingdom. And he says, if you will give me authority, I will finance the killing of all of these troublemakers for you. King, I will take care of it. Why? Well, his reason is because Mordecai is a Jew and he hates all Jews. Sometimes people make a mistake, do they not, of getting mad at one person in the church and leaving the church. I find that remarkable. You see it happen a lot of times. Well, he didn't speak to me, she didn't speak to me, or, you know, my name was not mentioned and or whatever, you know. And they just get mad at someone. And that's not to say that they were not mistreated in the church, but just get mad at one person and so you throw the whole church away. Don't ever do that. You know, you're throwing away the redeemed body of Jesus Christ, and sure there are members of the church that don't do right and that will mistreat you. You know, just ask the Apostle Paul and understand that. Ask Jesus about a man named Judas in relationship to that. But Haman's hatred of Mordecai is so deep that he says, here's my solution. King Ahasuerus, I will give you 10,000 pieces of silver. Well, how much money is that? Well, secular history shows, and I've got that on the slide, that the annual revenue to operate Ahasuerus' kingdom was 14,000 pieces of silver. Now, you think about governing 127 provinces and the amount of expense that would be involved in that. And the taxation money, the money that that came back to Ahasuerus was 14,000 pieces of silver. So Haman says, I will personally give you 10,000 pieces of silver. And so the king gave him his ring. We don't fully understand the authority there is in the ring. We don't understand it. But a ring, well, let me see if I can illustrate it this way. When the prodigal came home, what'd they give him? Gave him a robe. He was in ragged clothes. They gave him shoes. Remember the spiritual that came from the culture, I've got shoes, you got shoes, all of God's children's got shoes. Slaves didn't have, in American history, didn't have shoes. But then he said, and give that son a ring. That ring's authority to do what you want to. Give your son a credit card that has no limit on it. That's what he gave him. Well, he had a comment.
Yeah. Maybe I can shed some light on the king's ring.
Uh-huh.
That was authority. The king had a signet ring that he would put ink on in the olden days and stamp it on a seal. That was the seal that says that my law can be changed.
That's right. It's his signature, isn't it? It's the king's signature. And, it's like, Wiley, it's like that little piece of lead you've got on your power box. You ever seen that? So we can't get out and change the power box at your, I guess they still have those. Mine had one before they started reading it electronically. I don't know, but on that power, there's a little piece of lead there and had wires inside of it. And it was put there by FPNL. And if you broke that seal, you were in trouble. They sealed the tomb of Jesus. Very same kind of thing. It was government authority. It's do not cross the police ropes, the lines here. You understand that in our culture and everything. And so they sealed up the tomb of Jesus in relationship to that. Make it as sure as you can. So he gets the signet ring. And the plan to destroy the Jews. Now, all of this happens in the first month of the 12th year of Ahasuerus's reign. The 12th year. Now, we just read it's in the first chapter. Talks about it was in the third year. And so, in the first month of the year, they has that ring, and lots are cast to decide when the Jews should be destroyed. If I talk about reading tea leaves, you understand, you know, you look at the leaves that are in the bottom of the cup, and somebody that can read tea leaves can tell you everything's going to happen. In biblical times, they would look at the liver of an animal that they killed, and the message of the shape of that liver would tell them when they ought to do something. And so there are various ways of casting lots. You know, we think about rolling dice or something, you know, that type of thing. I don't know how they did it, but they cast lots, and the lot came back that 12 months later, in the 12th month, on the 13th day of the month, that all the Jews were to be killed. And so that word lot in the Persian language is pur, P-U-R, or pure. And so we're going to read in Jewish history about the Feast of Purim. So whenever you read about the Feast of Purim, understand that you're talking about when they cast lots. And so they read the tea leaves, they rolled the dice, in some way, you know, they decided that the very right time to do this was 12 months later. Now the Jews have really got to do something to counteract that. What can they do? Well, Queen Esther's there, you know, queen of the world. But she's not the most powerful person in on this earth, because remember what happened to Vashti whenever she got out of line? But Mordecai, when he hears of this decree in chapter 4, he clothes himself in sackcloth and ashes, and he's crying out, evidently weeping in some way about all of the turmoil that is about to come. He goes into the capital city, Shushan, where the king's palace is, and he's weeping. Clothed in sackcloth, he comes to where Esther is, but he can't get in. Not that he was necessarily trying to get in, but in his remorse, as he's going around weeping, he arrives where the palace is, and you cannot get into the king's palace dressed in sackcloth. If you're going to go to a banquet, you got to dress for it. And so he comes and he's not allowed to. Well, Esther hears that he's out there, and she sends clothes, good clothes, for him to wear. She doesn't understand for sure what's going on. It's rather remarkable. You know, somebody comes, one of the eunuchs comes and says, you know, your cousin Mordecai, he's out there and he's wailing and he's weeping and he's grieving about something. And so she sends him some clothes so that he might have access to find out what's going on and everything. I'm not sure everything, motivation about all of this, but she sends him some clothes. And he sends the messenger back. And we always say, and Mordecai said to Esther. That's not what happened. Mordecai gave this message, not to Esther, but to the man who brought him the clothes. And so he goes back to Esther, and he tells Esther, you know what's happening? Do you understand the tragic thing that is happening? And that is, your nation is about to be destroyed. And he says, oh, by the way, that includes you. And there is an amazing message, and I want to spend some time looking at that. In chapter 4, a part of this message asks Esther this question. Is it possible that you have been brought to this place for this very time? How are we going to save the nation? If there's anybody that can save the nation that has a decree that's an irrevocable decree that says every Jew is to be killed. You cannot change the law. Ahasuerus just cannot stand up and say, all right, I'm going to rescind that. I'm going to repeal that presidential decision, that presidential decree. I'll just go in there and I'll just rescind it. No, cannot do it. Persian law could not be amended. Just could not happen. But Mordecai says, Esther, you may be the only hope. Now, how's all that going to fall out? That's what we're going to be discussing next week, you know, some of it, and in relationship to this. But he says to Esther, how do you know that you're not at this very place for this very purpose? What is that? Is that chapter 4? I don't think we've got the verses underlined. I got it underlined in my mind. I'm sure it's in 13, 14, or 15 somewhere in there, isn't it? Do you not think in your heart that you will, do not think in your heart, that's in verse 13, that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews? If you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? I want you to think about that. Is it possible that God has you in a particular place at a particular time? The answer is, I don't know. I love that about providence. There are two things I love about Mordecai's statement. First is his evidence of faith. God has made a promise to Abraham, and God cannot lie, that in the seed of Abraham, all of the world is going to be blessed. Now, I don't know how God's going to work it out. This much I know, God cannot lie, and the Jews are going to be delivered, and I don't have any idea how it's going to happen. And Esther, if you fall by the wayside, you'll die. But that doesn't mean the Jews are going to die, because you're not the only source of God accomplishing His purpose. Who knows but what you've been brought to the kingdom for such a time as this? If you want to make your life rich, think about where you are right now and the people that's in your life right now. John, you had a comment. Yes, and she was popular. He loves her. King Ahasuerus loves her and shows her favor as you develop the rest of the story. But, we can't give the answers to all of this about how all this falls out. But if she goes to King Ahasuerus, if she just goes and says, honey, I need to talk to you. Your wife ever say that to you? We need to talk. Those are Judah's words that just chill me to the bone. We need to talk. You know, I don't think it's going to be love talk for some reason, you know. We just need to talk. And she can't do it. If she walks into the king's palace uninvited, he can put her to death. Just like that. And you see, that's what he'd done with Vashti. He got rid of Vashti. Why? Because she's not a submissive wife. I told her to come, she's not going to come. And if she walks in there and tries to tell me how to run the world, I'm in trouble. Now, why that decree is not irrevocable. It has to do with Persian law that's been set up and set up and set up and set up by armies and by kings that were before and everything. At some time, that decree was agreed to by all the people of the world. It's not, he is the king of the world, but he's not the dictator of the world, because there is Persian law that is more powerful than him. I guess, I don't know if that makes sense or not. But I want you to stop and think about it. How do you know you've not been brought to the kingdom for such a time as this? Guys, it makes life exciting. Nurse's shift changed last night, 7 o'clock. This young lady walks in, bubbly as can be, just as energetic as can be. And I started talking to her, find out a little about her. She's from the Philippines. She'd been in the States for 5 years and everything. And her family's not here, and so I finally said, "Where do you go to church? Where do you go to church?" And she said, "I can't." I said, "Is it?" She says, "It's out by, is that Ibis that's out there? I mean, it's some, you know." And she said, "It's a Catholic church." And I just happen to have in my pocket one of these things you need to keep in your pocket. You need to keep them in your wallet. You need to keep them in your purse. And I said, "Could I tell you of a church that is really, really exciting? You need to come. You need to come to visit this church." And I said, "You'd really be welcome." And I said, "We've got 20-something nations in this church. Man, we need to have somebody from the Philippines in this church. I don't know, you know, you understand?" And she started smiling, and she said, "I'll be there." Well, Dan, aren't you wonderful? No. If she's a seeker of truth, it has zero to do with Dan Jenkins. If I had not given, God is going to keep His promise. If you're hungry and thirsting after righteousness, God is going to keep His promise. It's not dependent on Dan. Deliverance will arise from another cause. I mean, that's the nature of God. And so we're only a part of this plan of God, and it makes it so exciting. Did He put me there at that time? I don't care. I don't need to know that, because there'll be another nurse that'll come in at 7 o'clock tonight. And, you know, and you understand what I mean? It just makes life exciting to every person that you meet. Now, I don't give a card to everybody I meet. Maybe I should. But if I can get the conversation headed over there in that direction, you know. And the amazing thing is, she doesn't even know I'm the preacher. I love that aspect of it, you know. She says, I'll be coming for such a time as this. How many more minutes we got? One held up one finger, the other held up 2.5, okay. The third person baptized in Fiji. Ron and I just baptized George and Teresa over on the other side of the island, went to Suva, the capital city, trying to find a student on a Bible correspondence course, a man walking down the road. And there are no street names, there are no house numbers or anything. "Sir, could you help us? You know this name?" "Yeah, he lives in this house." I mean, we'd gotten close. And I go into the house, and it's the worst 30 or 45 minutes I've ever spent. 14-year-old kid, cannot talk directly to him because his father's there. It's disrespectful to talk to the son and not to the father. So here I am speaking English to a guy who's taken a correspondence course trying to learn English, and he's trying to translate my English to his father. And I come out 30 or 45 minutes later, and I'm exhausted. And Ron's standing outside, said, "Dad, come and meet Fiopati Elisara." Said that we're going to his house to study the Bible tonight. We walked into the house. And we walked in the house, and Fiopati said, "I've heard all my life about the church that John Wesley started. And today I've learned about the church that Jesus started. I want to be a part of it." Boy, aren't Dan and Ron great? No! Had it been us, God had made a promise to a man who's looking for the truth. So we stood with him another couple of hours and we baptized him. He said, I'm not a Fijian. I'm from the Gilbert and Ellis Islands, and I'm a lay preacher up there in the LMS church, and I want to go back and tell everybody in the LMS church about the church that Jesus started. Phil Potty, why were you walking down that road that day? I asked him that a year or so later. He said, it's rather ironic. I worked at the sugar mill there, and I'd cut my hand pretty bad. They said, don't come to work tomorrow. Go to the doctor. I went to the doctor that morning, and they said, the doctor can't see you. Come back this afternoon. And I was walking down that road that afternoon when you guys stopped me and said, do you know this person? Is that exciting? I challenge you to do something you and I have been doing for the last 5 years. Our prayer is this. You don't have to spurt it this way. God, we're both getting older and there's not much place for us left in the church. Use us every time you can, and it'll open your eyes. When Dolly walked in last night with that energy from the Philippines, and when she walked out, I said to Judy, and that's the kind of thing we've been praying about. I challenge you to say, God, I don't know anything, but use me. That's it for the class tonight. We're not through with this, but it gets even better. If you haven't studied the book of Esther, it gets even better.